Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking today with Robert Kissel, who is Professor Emeritus of History and Government, was for a number of years History Department Chair, and taught other subjects as well, and taught at the college, at the Williamsport Area Community College, from 1965 until his retirement in 1985. Bob, you were raised in a small town, Collinsville, and your father worked at AFCO like Cumming. How did that background relate to your eventual teaching at the Williamsport Area Community College?
Actually, Dan, I don't think there was any real correlation between the two, to be honest about it. My father at AFCO, machinist, obviously, and I recalled just recently that he was offered a job here himself when he was at the AFCO, and Ewing Muesler was one of those people who accepted the opportunity and came here. It's ironic that 50 years later I took a position that my father didn't accept, but it really had nothing to do with my coming to the community college, really.
But it gave you maybe an understanding of people and students who were interested in machining, manufacturing, things of that sort?
Oh, absolutely. That plus the fact that over the years, and I don't want to give you a litany of what I've done, but prior to my becoming a teacher and during between semesters at college and everything, heavens, I worked everywhere from a stock boy at L.L. Stearns's to the Weldon Pajama Factory to the New York Central Railroad to building the Pine Creek Dam, to helping build the Mosquito Valley Reservoir, which is the source of Williamsport's water supply. And the list goes on. I even worked as a janitor for Montour Oil while my daughter was in college. So basically, I've always had a real empathy for the working man, the so-called blue-collar worker. And it's kind of funny that when I retired, I guess in my teaching, I referred to the working man as Joe Dinner Bucket so frequently that my colleagues gave me a black dinner bucket with Joe Dinner Bucket name on it. So, no, it's that relationship with the working man. I got my hands dirty in my earlier days.
Good. Thank you. You enlisted toward the latter part of the Second World War right out of high school into the U.S. Navy. Would you talk about that and maybe where that led you?
That's correct. I went to a one-room, eighth-grade school over in Collinsville and then to the Jersey Shore High School in the early 40s. And I can only say that it must have been because recruiters were in the high school. Now they complain if they're in the college, but they were in the high school, and I was motivated to join the Air Force, which I was not able to do because they didn't pass the eye test. But myself and about three other guys enlisted in the service and left our senior year to, I went into the Navy, which meant Philadelphia for a physical and shots, then a long train ride overnight up to Sampson, New York, which is on Lake Geneva, for boot camp, and then from boot camp down to Bainbridge, Maryland, where I got my first, by that time they'd figured out that I was cut out to be a hospital corpsman. And I went to hospital corps school in Bainbridge, Maryland. And when I graduated from that, I got transferred to the Quantico Marine Base, where I was the corpsman for a Marine Air Infantry Group, and spent the remaining part of the war there and at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital upon discharge in June of 1946.
And then you became connected briefly with the Williamsport Technical Institute after leaving the service, is that correct?
It was only a connection by virtue of the fact that I came here to be interviewed by the Veterans Administration to ascertain what my inclinations might be. And I remember taking a battery of tests in one of the shop buildings around here and then returning the next day for a verbal interview, and they concluded on the basis of aptitude and psychological testing and so forth that I ought to be in marketing or in the ministry or in education. And you're smiling already. That's because I had determined that I was too bad to be a minister. So I thought, gee, teaching might be nice for me. And off I went to Lock Haven State, teacher's college at that particular time. And in all seriousness, I do recall walking up that front sidewalk and looking at that administration building and having an epiphany experience, thinking, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is meant for me. And I enrolled there. I always had a sort of a natural inclination for history and government and geography. I liked it in school, and it was sort of a natural thing for me to want to share that interest. And I majored in history as a major and geography as a minor at Lock Haven State.
And then after you graduated from Lock Haven, you were temporarily recalled to service because of the Korean War. Is that correct?
I graduated in June of 51, and 2 weeks later, I was back in a Navy uniform. And to my amazement, there were other members of my class of 51 that went off to Korea. And I thought, this will be my destiny. But instead, would you believe that they sent me back to Bainbridge, Maryland, where I became an instructor in anatomy and physiology. You figure that out. You know, here I'm a history and government man, and I'm teaching anatomy and physiology. Class of about 70 in the class. You learn to lecture, and you learn to vocalize and articulate and enunciate and project. And to this day, I have people I'll bang into who will say, oh, yeah, I remember you. It's your voice that I remember, you know. So I guess I was always a big mouth, whatever, but nobody ever had any problem hearing me. So, yes, Bainbridge, Maryland is where I spent another year then in the Navy. And upon discharge, June, a year later, I came home and looked for a job. Never dreamed of sending out resumes to become a teacher. My father worked at Avco. He got me a job at Avco. I went to work at Avco. And my father had a little bit of influence there. He got me a job back over where they were rebuilding motors, truck motors. And I was involved in tearing them down and disassembly, and it was a dirty, greasy, grimy job. And it lit the fire under me to get your butt in gear and get out of here. You know, so therefore I did send some resumes around, and I went down to Susquehanna, which ironically was another new school system, a jointure between Duncannon and Marysville. And when I got there that night to be interviewed for this job in the history department, lo and behold, there were 22 other guys there. And they interviewed us one at a time before the school board. And as they come out, they left and went home. When I came out for my interview, they asked me to remain. And it was well after midnight that they called me in and told me that I had the job as a history and geography teacher at Susquehanna. Is where I got my feet wet. And I loved it there, spent 3 years there, ran into a teacher from Endoresville High School at a conference over in Shippensburg, and he said, oh, we're going to have an opening up in Montoursville High School. And my wife and I were happy in Duncannon, but we thought, gee, home is really South Williamsport, Montoursville, Loyal Sock, and no offense to Muncie, but we felt Montoursville's the town we want to live in, you know. So in fall of 1955, came to Montoursville, where I joined the faculty of the high school and remained there from 55 to 65.
And you were very successful there in teaching, and you had responsibilities advising the student government, and you were head of your department. And then 10 years later, something happens here at the college. It becomes the Williamsport Technical Institute becomes the Williamsport Area Community College, and you apply. How'd that come about?
I loved my 10 years at the Montoursville High School. Loved the kids, loved the challenge, loved moving from Pennsylvania history to geography to world cultures, going from 7th to 8th graders to sophomores, and then the seniors with problems of democracy. And I loved every time I escalated to another age level. I liked it. Liked working with the student council, liked chaperoning dances at the high school gymnasium, liked going to the football games, and enjoyed it very much. But for some reason or another, unexplained to me, when the college was born, quote unquote, and there was an opening. I don't even know how I learned about it, but I applied. I came up for an interview in Dr. Carl's office with him and Dr. John Bone from Lock Haven State, who was on the board of trustees here. It's three people. We had the interview, and when I left, they asked me, did I have any more questions? And I said, when can I start? And all jokes aside, I was hired as an assistant professor of history and government, one of the very first of five or six people in that so-called liberal arts program at the time, which was really a nucleus. Very few students, very few faculty, and that was the beginning of another 20-year episode in my life, of which I also totally enjoyed the train ride.
The term that was used for you at Small Hanville you talked about was original astronauts. You remember that term?
Yeah, I do. Because there were so few of us. Today there's 100 astronauts, but back in those days there were only like 20 or whatever, and I did refer to myself as an original astronaut. I still wear that badge proudly because it was Tom Vargo, myself, Hugh McMullen, Ron Thompson. I might miss someone, but there was a mere handful of us in the liberal arts program, now the humanities and whatever.
So that liberal arts program essentially was for students who would be transferring to other colleges and also provided general education to the students in the vocational technical programs.
That's absolutely.
That had previously been part of the Williamsport Technical Institute.
That's absolutely correct, yes.
But in effect, you were the first teacher of history and government at the...
Oh, yes.
Either the Williamsport...
The only one. The only one.
Okay. Thank you. Do you recall your first faculty meeting when the college, the Williamsport Area Community College convened?
I do. And again, I sat there with probably my blue blazer and my tie on and listened to Dr. Carl address the faculty, many of which had been here for years because they were a part of that technical institute, which had its nucleus in World War II under Dr. Parks. Dr. Parks was still around, but Dr. Carl was the spokesperson. And I remember vividly his comments that day about the challenges of the future. And he, in my mind, invented the expression field of dreams long before Kevin Costner ever thought about it, because he envisioned the college expanding all the way from 3rd Street to the Susquehanna River. And lo and behold, if you build it, they will come. And in essence, the college was built and the students came. And they came from everywhere. Originally, Sayre, Montandon, Montgomery, Loyal Sauk, Montoursville, Sunbury, Susquehanna, Altoona. And later, of course, they came from out of state to the institution and so forth. But that's what I remember so much about the very beginning. But as a liberal arts guy, I was in the minority of a very small handful of technical people.
The students, of course, were coming primarily from 20 sponsoring school districts, so in addition to that, from most of the areas of the state. And did you see any differences, therefore, because of that variety of backgrounds or places that with your, let's say, your seniors at Montoursville?
Yeah, a huge difference. Montoursville was pretty cosmopolitan with regard to race, age levels, et cetera, et cetera. When you got to the college here, you had a demographic that was more made up of, other than just college freshmen, you would have married students, you would have veterans, you would have some retirees, you would have racial minorities, and you would also have some of your own technical institute faculty incorporated in your classes because there was an incentive for them to enhance their own educational backgrounds, pay-wise, promotion-wise, and so forth. So it was more of a diverse teaching group, which made it more fun, more challenging, and more interesting.
Yeah. You talked about Dr. Carl, the first president of the Williamsport Area Community College, the founding president. What was he like?
I think he was the right man at the right time at the right place. Very unpretentious, as were most of the, all of the administrators. There was a, we kind of had that Pittsburgh Pirates, we are family, kind of an attitude. And I never saw anybody flaunt their position, I'm dean of this and that, or look down their nose at you. It was one big family. And you could say hello to a dean or a president or a vice president as well as you would one of your faculty colleagues, et cetera. It was one big family, really.
You said you and Dr. Carl had something in common when you'd walk around.
Yeah, I guess it might have been our depression background or whatever, I don't know. But we moved, of course, when I first came here, it was virtually night school for me, you know. And there weren't that many classrooms occupied by classes. And I would go down a hall to my classroom on my way to a class, walk by a classroom where the lights were blazing and no one in, and I would turn it off, turn the lights off. Well, I saw Dr. Carl do that many and many a time, but he's the only one beside myself I ever saw turn lights off in an empty classroom, and that's what we had that in common.
You talked about it being essentially night school. Would you explain?
Well, you couldn't get into, because we were teaching in Clump, which was still the high school until the castle on the hill was built, no pun intended there or whatever. It's a wonderful institution. But at any rate, I had to wait for Mr. Jones, the high school English teacher, to vacate his class until I could get mine in there. So basically, we couldn't begin classes until 4 o'clock. For the first several years of my teaching career was a 4 o'clock, a 7 o'clock, an 8 o'clock, that kind of thing on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, or Tuesday or Thursday. The Tuesday or Thursday classes obviously were 90 minutes. The Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, 50 minutes, which is still pretty traditional with regard to class time, et cetera. Yep, leave here many a time at 10 o'clock at night.
Where was your first office or offices?
My first offices, our first offices here at the Technical Institute, which became the Community College, was I was in the Straley Building, which was immediately west of the gymnasium on 3rd Street. And Hugh McMullen and I shared an office there. And I think later you may have been in there, Dr. Doyle. And it was later raised, whatever the word is, for construction. And then we moved into cubicles over on the trolley barn. And you had to go up this concrete steps with steel railings and that sort of thing and be in your own little cubicle, which is much like some of the ads you see on TV today for businesses. But it was fun, and it was part of the process, you know. That was our offices. Then later, we moved into the high school because of seniority, I guess. I was fortunate enough to have and to share with you, Dan Doyle, the old yearbook office, which had windows to the west. And it was a very pleasant environment. You could see students coming down the hallway to go to their classes. You could hear them and enjoyed it there a great deal. And then I think later on, Jim Loeb shared that office. Maybe Dick Sweeney as well.
I thank you for picking a wonderful office with a great view and sunlight.
Yes. Well, I picked that one.
You did a great job. What was the campus like when you came in 65?
I've jokingly referred to with speaking to students about the campus, I would say to use the word campus loosely. You had to use your imagination to refer to this as a campus if you'd been to Lock Haven State and Bloomsburg and Penn State and so forth. But a campus to me, in many ways, is like a church that's destroyed by a hurricane or a typhoon or a tornado. The campus is made up of faculty and students and administration, and in that sense, we had a campus in the truest sense of the word. The camaraderie, the atmosphere was here, but in all true sense of the word, a campus, as you would imagine it, did not exist. It was not until the late 1970s that we had our first building expansion and boom under Dr. Federson, which was welcomed and envisioned. And then, of course, later in the late 80s, under Dr. Bruder and the current president, my, oh, my, oh, my, you drive aboard now. I bring people from out of town for a ride up here just to show them the campus that I'm so proud of. It's like being on the campus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's wonderful, and it's great to live to be old enough to see it.
Yeah. Well, it brings back memories of the Straley building that you talked about a few minutes ago. It was on the corner of Susquehanna Street and West 3rd Street, and the Susquehanna Street went down what is currently the malls at the ATHS. There were a lot of trucks going down that toward the end of that property to the city dump. Do you
I do.
Talk about that?
Yeah, I do remember that for a long time we shared this campus with things other than a college. There were right-of-ways that existed, businesses on the fringe of the campus that existed, and needless to say, you don't overnight remove that. I do remember those trucks, yes.
Describe some of the classrooms other than in the academics, what is now the academic center that you taught in. Once the liberal arts classes, gen ed classes switched to daytime, even before the college got hold of and ownership of the current academic center.
Yeah, well, see, the current academic center, the classrooms would have been traditional high school type classrooms, blackboard, fixed furniture, lectern maybe, etc. But later on, of course, then we started filling all the nooks and crannies around this place as the enrollment increased. And I remember going up the steps beyond the school nurses. College had nurses in those days. I remember the two originals. But up a set of steps to a very low-ceilinged, concrete-floored room that was narrow and long, students wide left and right and narrow this way, and not well lighted, and that was one of them.
That was in Unit 6.
That's right. That was the administration building,
right,
and the trolley barn. Yeah, and kind of a cold environment.
And where else did you teach?
Oh, let's
Ritual?
See.
Did you teach in Ritual?
We taught in the Ritual building. Again, you could hear the furniture, the machines running upstairs from the manufacturing that was going on while you taught your classes. That's a truism as well. But it was an interesting experience, yeah.
The liberal arts program was completely new to what had been the Williamsport Technical Institute. Were you involved in curriculum development and the selection of courses that you would teach and so forth?
Well, for quite a lengthy time, I was chairman of the Curriculum Development Committee. But basically, most of the development was projected on needs. We found out that the college needed this or needed that. And in the area that I was involved in, basically, I always had a catalog from Lock Haven State, Millersville, Mansfield, or around, like coming to look at the four-year program of those people. And you could see that you needed general psychology, you needed sociology, you needed intro to, no, not intro to ed, but you needed Psych 1, you needed Lit 1, and all these basic courses if you were going to have people prepared to transfer to other institutions. So that pretty much dictated what we added. Plus, as the years went by and the enrollment increased, the demand increased for a wider variety of things in journalism and elsewhere. And we devised courses to meet those needs.
And the students that you were advising were going to many of those institutions that you named, particularly the state college system as it was known at that time. Do you have any memories of students transferring to various colleges?
Oh, I do. And I had no relationship with working out any agreement between those institutions, which originally they had at the very beginning. The administration people did that sort of thing. But I do recall sitting down with students and realizing, now, what are your long-range plans for yourself? You know, where do you expect to be 4 years from now, and that kind of thing. And in light of that, I would always make sure that we tracked them into courses that were going to transfer and that would not spin their wheels and waste their time when they got to that four-year institution. And you wanted to make sure that all the courses that they were taking were transferable. Time was money, credits are money, and you wanted to be as efficient as you could be along those particular lines. And frequently I would have students come back and I'd meet them at a party or something somewhere or whatever, and they would tell me how grateful they were for the one-on-one advising that they got from their instructors, not just me, but from everybody in the humanities or liberal arts area, because they didn't get that always at some of the institutions that they transferred to, according to what they told me.
So that small size of the liberal arts program fostered that closer relationship?
I think so, yes.
Okay. What about the relationship between the liberal arts faculty and the what was then called the applied arts faculty?
I think that it was tremendous. There was a lot of camaraderie. There was no one felt that because I wear a shirt and a tie that I'm better than you who wear a schmuck. There was none of that kind of an attitude, I don't think, at all. But over the years, I've been kind of disappointed at the lack of integration that took place between the quote-unquote college transfer people or the professors as opposed to those who were technical instructors, because I don't think we ever really integrated as much as we might have. Witness the picnics that were held. They had picnics and they were dominated by the technical arts area, which would be natural because they were greater in number. But not many of the liberal arts, quote unquote, people chose to attend those things. Today, if you go to a retirement dinner, which I have for 20 plus years, you'll find a mere handful, myself and one or two other people there from that area. And I don't know what it is that that blending has never really been what I would have wished it would have been over the years. I don't think it's any better than thou attitude. I don't think it's that. It might just be that they feel they don't have something in common with a welder or whatever. I don't know.
You talked about the picnics. Where were some of those first picnics held?
Some of our first picnics were with Brass, Clyde Brass's farm, and they were great. The food was great. The outing was great. It was fun. And just in general, basically that's where he hosted the early ones. And then later, we actually started to split into where the technical areas had theirs. And there was one big college picnic. It could be down at the Kremser Landing in Fort Toursville, where we had a picnic and played ball and softball, and Bruder aggressively participated in these things. But we had picnics at some of our private homes. My wife and I entertained our faculty group out at Route 87 for many, many years and tremendously enjoyed having people there.
And Best Beach, I believe, was...
Oh, yes, that was early on. I'm glad you reminded me of that.
How did that connect with Bill Best and the sign painting at the college?
Well, Bill Best had the sign painting division, and he had this trailer park for mobile homes or whatever up on the Loyal Sock, and a small picnic pavilion area along the Loyal Sock, and he graciously shared that with us in the early years. Yes, I went there with my wife and others.
Instead of a college council and governance system that exists today, there was a loosely structured all faculty and all academic administrative staff approach in those early years of the community college that would meet in large rooms and eventually in the auditorium of the now academic center. What do you recall of those gatherings?
Well, I recall them quite vividly. Now, you're talking about before we just had our divisional meeting with our deans or whatever. Obviously, we nearly filled that high school auditorium, and I remember pretty much it was to go there and to listen more than it was to participate in a dialogue. And very rarely did one stand up and, for example, confront Dr. Bruder with questions, which I recall that I did on more than one occasion, and would have faculty say something to me about it afterwards, because I affectionately referred to Dr. Bruder as Dr. Von Bruder. You listened to him. You didn't tell him, you know, and that kind of thing. But I wasn't, I'd been around long enough that I wasn't apprehensive about sharing whatever views I might have had with him. But it was not a give-and-take session, by and large, not the main group.
Well, you always did that with a smile on your face. I think that's
yeah.
why you were
well,
able to
perhaps.
Pull it off. But I was thinking, even earlier than that, when in the time of Dr. Carl in particular, and shortly after that, where all faculty would come together and literally vote on curriculum issues and things of that sort. Do you remember any of those meetings?
I remember the meetings, but specifics I'd be pretty shady on.
When Dr. Fedderson became president in the early 70s, you had been a department chair of history for a number of years, and he created a divisional structure. Would you explain the difference in from an organizational standpoint?
Before I answer that question, if I could flash back to your previous one just for one brief moment, I do recall an issue that came up in these meetings with regard to the quarter system. We had a spring semester and a fall semester and a spring semester, which meant, of course, that your students came here after Labor Day and they got out sometime after a lame duck session after the Christmas holidays. And many people thought that that was an inefficient way to operate. So the college did vote on a quarter system, which meant that you functioned pretty much year-round. And you had students in various programs, which meant that they didn't all interlock. And it was quite a confusing situation, which, by the way, did not fly after a while. Fred Bearley, who went on to Bucknell, was partially instrumental in bringing that about. But that was an example of issues that were brought up that we tried but was not successful. Just a flashback to what
sure.
you're...
Thank you.
Now, with regard to your current question...
The switch from very many small departments to elimination of department heads and creation of a divisional structure which would combine, for example, in what eventually became integrated studies, actually two separate divisions, communications, humanities and social sciences, and then math, science, and allied health. That was by Dr. Fedderson around the mid-70s. What do
yep.
you recall about that?
Well, I recall, and I say this with no ego in mind at all, but I recall being offered the chairmanship of that particular division, but I was happy doing what I was doing. I was not an administrative type person, and I chose not to do it. But I remember Middleton and others like yourself who were chair of this particular, Veronica, of course. And it was wonderful, the camaraderie and the cooperation that existed in these divisions. I remember our meetings. I remember the advent of the computers and how we could communicate with off-campus people and the growth and the expansion that took place in that area. And it was great. It was another stepping stone in the expansion and the diversification of the college.
During the early 70s, the general education or core requirements for gen ed were significantly changed, which followed sort of a nationwide trend to give students more selection in their courses. As a result, history was dropped as a requirement in most programs, and that meant that you had to teach more than history because fewer students were now taking history. So what happened and what was that experience like?
Well, that's very true. Originally, I taught Western Civ, which I was never really happy with because I didn't feel that I was really truly qualified to give a great course in Western Civ. And fortunately, you came along and I could pass it on. But American history was easy, my forte. American government, easy, my forte. However, I did adapt to sociology. It's an easy course to teach. It's a course that students are interested in. And introduction to education was, I loved teaching intro to ed. And later, problems of secondary education. And it showed my interest in teachers because early in my career, I had student teachers at the Montoursville High School from Lycoming College and from Lock Haven State. And I had this relationship between education and teacher training. And in my early years here at the college, I also went over to Lycoming College and taught some courses as later people did, like Jim Logue and perhaps yourself, I'm not sure, went down to the federal penitentiary to teach some courses. But all of that made it a natural thing for me to spill over into these new challenges, which I accepted with delight. I liked the change. It was interesting.
College admissions in the late 60s, after the formation of the community college, early 70s, it faced some opportunities and challenges. Would you talk about that?
Explain yourself a little.
Well, as far as the campus in particular and housing.
Oh, I understand what you're driving at, yes. College admissions. Well, needless to say, with graphic arts and some of the unique programs in the technical area, including architecture and so forth, we had wide appeal beyond commuting distances, which attracted students from out of town, Altoona, Sayre. They would come here, talk with the admissions people, talk with the curriculum people, sign up for a program with their parents with them, women among them, young girls out of high school. They would leave this session with their administrative people here at the college and go out into the surrounding area to seek housing on 3rd and 4th Street and come back and tell Lucille Cohen, director of housing or admissions, was it, that they couldn't stay. They had to withdraw before they really enrolled because they could not leave their daughter in housing like that. And I remember Lucille Cohen telling me with tears in her eyes that this was true. And that played an early role in eliminating women from. Now, when you look at the demographics today, we have women's lib here at the Technical Institute, which became the college, in every sense of the word, from enrollment to faculty, because we built state-of-the-art housing. We built things that were necessary for people who couldn't commute on a daily basis to be housed in housing that their parents could be comfortable with, that they could be comfortable with, and hooray for the people that had the foresight to see that this was a necessary ingredient. Because a lot of people thought, what does a community college need with housing? You know, you meet the needs of your sponsoring districts and let it go at that. But we went far beyond meeting the needs of our sponsoring districts. Even a library. I remember one of the members of the Board of Trustees, when library funding was mentioned, and I give this quote as I remember it, and it's not embellished in any way, shape, or form. What do they need with money for a library for? What's a technical institute need with a library? Well, the guy must have had his head between his tail or something, you know? How can you function as an educational institution without a library? You know, it's like a kitchen without tools, you know? So therefore, and look at the Madigan Library today. I walked in there and how proud I was to see that place and just to think, my, oh my, how far we've come, you know?
Did students ever describe the housing they were in, or did you ever see student housing?
I saw it, and yes, they would talk about it when you went through advising areas. Even had some students living with a guy, you know, and I'd say, I don't think Mom would like this all that much, you know. Had one girl come in crying one day because some guy had shoved her around. And I recall telling her, get out, go home, pack your bags, and move immediately. Because some of that housing just left a great deal. I hate to call them opportunistic landlords, but they didn't provide very well. And yeah, I saw some of that stuff.
And of course, there was no supervision.
No supervision. No oversight. The city didn't really monitor it like they seem to do today for off-campus housing.
Well, when the Williamsport Technical Institute became the Williamsport Area Community College, one of the new opportunities it had was college athletics, and you had some experience with that. Would you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, it was wonderful. My gosh, they had basketball, they had hockey, they had, I don't know whether they had hockey or not, maybe we take that back. But they had girls basketball, boys basketball, they had wrestling, a great wrestling team. Max Wasson developed a wrestling team here that competed very, very well with the Penn State campuses, with Bucknell's JVs, with Lyte Cummings JVs. I used to be the scorer, and I loved it. They had archery, and I recall in recent years they've been national champions in archery. They've done well, and they still have a great athletic program, and I probably did not elaborate enough on some of those early teams that they had, but they had them, and I was so glad they still have them. They had a band. There was a college band at that time. They called them the Wildcat Band. I don't know whether that exists today. They had a yearbook, which I'd like to talk about afterwards. They had a lot of things that they don't have today that I would like to see a college of this stature have. For example, I'm going to talk to some people about a rebirth of the yearbook. I'd like to talk to some people. I wear this college ring from Lock Haven State proudly. I've worn that for over a half century. I don't think the college has a class ring. I would like to see some competitive bidding on design. I would like to serve as a chairman to help select a ring. I would like to purchase the first one manufactured. I'd like to buy the first of the renewal yearbooks available. And I'd like to see those things happen to the college. They still do, fortunately, a great deal of programming. By programming, I mean lectures and musical people. I remember they had Stan Kenton. They had Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Jesse Owens was here. And I'll never forget Neil Diamond. We had Neil Diamond. We went to the concert. We're in the high school gym. And here he is in this little hick town, he thought, in this little gymnasium with hardly anybody in it. And at halftime, intermission, he wanted his money. He wasn't sure he was going to get paid. But I've been a Neil Diamond to this day. And I remember Bob, English prof, Bob, he and his wife, Rita, or Ulrich, they became great Neil Diamond fans, and they travel all over the East to go to Neil Diamond fans. But the college still does programs like that, and I'm glad every college ought to have a cultural arts program, whatever they refer to it. But we had it. We had astronauts. I'm not sure whether it was Neil Armstrong or Carpenter or whatever, but we had some astronauts here as well. That's where I got that original astronaut thing.
As I recall, you were advisor to the activities when Neil Diamond was here, and I believe you stepped in and said, no, you're going to get your pay after you do your final performance.
That's correct. Yeah. And,
you told me that story the very next day.
Oh, really? That's just
so it stuck in my memory, too. Thank you for sharing it. Increasingly, during the 70s and 80s, the 20 sponsoring school districts challenged the college administration in a variety of ways, particularly primarily in passing the budget.
Yeah.
What was your experience regarding that, since you came from one of the important school districts, yeah, Montoursville? Did you experience comments at home and from former colleagues at the high school?
Well, interestingly enough, Montoursville was an original sponsor, and rightly so should have been, because when I was at the high school, we had many students who were not academically inclined, and that doesn't mean that they were any less in any way, shape, or form. But they came here as, we call them, tech rats. They enrolled in automotive, they enrolled in welding, they did this, they did that. And some of them still exist in the greater Montoursville area today doing their businesses, which are commendable. And the college recognized that there was a need for a technical institute, needless to say. And yes, they were one of those 20 sponsoring original school districts, which unfortunately entered into a 20-year agreement. And time clicks, you know, the bus goes by my house every half hour in Montoursville, and the first thing you know, 5 years becomes 20 years. But over the years, Montoursville, as well as the other districts, sent many and many and many a student. I can go through yearbooks and pick out name after name after name who attended here. Therefore, I could easily see why they would want to be a sponsoring school district. But as they themselves became a broader educational institute, becoming school jointures, and he referred to them as Montoursville Area Joint School, Jersey Shore Area Joint School in the beginning. Then he decided that word joint wasn't the best terminology to use, and they dropped that particular in the the Montoursville Area School District. But as they grew, enrollments increased, budgets increased, and therefore the college budget became source of criticism for some on the local school board who begrudged the money, even though if they would have looked at the books, they had plenty of kids enrolling here, and therefore it was a good thing for them and for the college and for the community, because as I facetiously said one time in an interview, when you go to the Williamsport Area Community College, when you graduate, you get a job. And our students were still being gainfully employed almost immediately. So therefore, why Montoursville ran out of patience, they shouldn't have, but they did. And as far as my relationship, no, it had no bearing on it. No one ever looked down their nose or looked at me or any other faculty member as a threat to their existence in any way, shape, or form. To this day, I'm as much of a family with them as I am here. As a matter of fact, I get invited to all their retirement dinners and to all their class reunions and so forth. To this day, I still do. And I go, I might add.
Your teaching years at the community college also covered the time, most of the years of the Vietnam War. You were a veteran yourself. What was your experience with students who maybe were, maybe male students who were coming to seek deferment from the draft, and for veterans who were increasingly then coming after they had served in the war? Do you have memories of that?
Yeah, I do. And first of all, let me make it quite clear, because of my age at the time of World War II and the Korean War, had I not existed, I would not have been in the service. Therefore, I'm not a combat veteran. So I want to preface my remarks by that. But yes, I was quite aware of the fact that we had this deferment issue. But again, I'm a believer in people doing what they're inclined to do and choosing not to do what they're not inclined to do. So therefore, I never, ever looked down my nose at someone that I felt was not inclined to serve their country in a military way, nor did I, if I can use the word, gay. If I recognize that this particular guy is a little effeminate or whatever, it never, ever occurred to me to be prejudiced against him or her. And by the same token, the same as those who opposed the Vietnam War. The campus was divided, the student body was divided, but not as they are today, where they get so much more vocal and violent over issues. But we did have these issues. It was divisive. We did have our debates and our sessions. And to my knowledge, I've never had a day you and I were on opposite sides of the coin. But it never affected our personal relationship, I don't think, for a day, and nor anyone else on the faculty at that time. It was a subjective problem to be dealt with, just as the Iraq situation is another repeat performance which is dividing the country. It's not wholesome. I don't know what the alternative is or what the answer will be, but we ultimately solved it in Korea, and hopefully there's light at the end of this tunnel, which will not be detrimental to the nation, whatever the solution might be.
Thank you. In 1973, the college faculty went on strike, which resulted in a temporary closure of the college for classes for 3 weeks. You were a department head at that time, and therefore were not part of the bargaining unit, and therefore were not on strike. What are your recollections of that time?
Well, yes, I do remember that. And I know your PhD background and your interest and so forth in the working man, and I too had. But for some reason or another, I never gravitated toward unions or belonging to a union, which they had in Montoursville High School after I left. They formed a teacher's union, and they had it here at the college, which by virtue of the fact that, as you pointed out, I'm a chairman, I wasn't involved in it. So therefore, I was not involved in the emotional aspects of it, in the economic aspects. Fortunately, it only lasted 3 weeks. And what they did with me, they sent me down to the aviation unit at the airport, where I basically babysat a unit and just occupied space and held things together until this solution came along to resolve the problem. Fortunately, it was not a long knock-em-out, drag-em-out affair, and I don't think it did permanent damage again, as I don't think the Vietnam War. Now, maybe there are harboring illnesses between certain people over that and over Vietnam, but if there is, I don't recall them or feel them or ever experience them. But no, that's what happened with me.
Which, yep. Should you feel more of a fish out of water teaching anatomy and physiology to in the Navy, or teaching aviation for that?
Well, the answer to that is easy, because I didn't teach anything in the aviation unit. I occupied a space and a presence, basically. But at the Bainbridge Hospital Core School, of all things, the Navy gave me an outline of the course. Here's the course. Here's what you teach. And basically, it was a subject of me staying 3 days ahead of the students, learning the terminology, the materia medica, and being able to vocalize it, project it, and get it done. And I did, you know. That wasn't a challenge.
You continued to teach for several years as an adjunct once you retired, teaching Introduction to Education. What was it like to return as an adjunct and to teach one course at a time?
Well, it was a blessing in many respects, because it was 1985 when I retired at 58 years old. And if you'll allow me to flash back to my beginnings again, we all know that education is not, you don't get rich. You're not a CEO of some corporate, whatever. But my beginning salary as a teacher at Susquehanna was $2,800. My salary when I went to Montoursville High School with a master's degree from Bucknell was $3,600. When I came to the college as an assistant professor in 1965, my salary was $7,500. And 30 years later, when I retired, with no hospitalization, by the way, my salary was $30,000. Well, at that time, as you indicated earlier in the discussion, enrollments were down, budgetary issues were a challenge here, and the college offered a buyout incentive of $10,000. I'd never seen $10,000 in one lump sum in my life. And my wife and I had been going with the kids to Sanibel Island in Florida, and I had this offer. And I'm sitting on the beach in Sanibel Island thinking about whether I should accept $10,000 and 35 years of experience and call it a day or not. And maybe that wasn't a good place to make a decision with a margarita in your hand, because I did. And I sent in the retirement papers, much to my mother's chagrin, who said, "You're too young to retire," and also said to me, "What do you want to do going down to Florida with all those old people, you know?" But nevertheless, I've had great years of retirement. And those few years that I came back to teach a course was sort of a weaning process. And I very much enjoyed that as well, because it kept me into the thing. But because the semester didn't end until somewhere around a week before Christmas, I didn't like the cold well enough to hang around that long. So I gradually stopped doing that. Then the college showed me some respect by bringing me back, after I stopped teaching, to be an advisor to some special challenged students whose schedules were kind of complicated, and they paid me an hourly wage, I'm not sure, I think it was $10, to schedule some students on a part-time basis. I did that a few hours a week for a while, and then ultimately washed my hands of the situation. I had a couple homes in Florida, over the winter only, spent 15 years down there, tired of that, sold the homes, washed my hands, and came back to my hometown. That's the guy from Jersey's song, and Montoursville, my hometown, and we're happy there. And I can put up with the weather, even though I don't like it. You know, so here we are.
Is there anything of significance you would like to add to your experience here at the community college for from 65 to 85?
Do you mind if I just glimpse in my pocket for a moment and see if I jotted anything down that we may have missed? Those fall weekends were neat. The road rallies that they had were neat with sports cars.
Fall weekends, yes.
We had a May Queen, we had a Spring Queen, and the kids had a chance to be a part of a college atmosphere for a weekend. They had picnics and it was wonderful. The boy-girl thing was wonderful. The dating thing was nice, and they had those fall weekends, which I thought added to the college atmosphere. I'm not sure whether they still put a float in the Mummer's Parade, but I bet they do. I would think that they probably do. The school newspaper, The Spotlight, does that still exist? The young man probably knows. My goodness. We need to give a rebirth to The Spotlight. What are all these journalism students doing, you know? Where are their faculty advisors? I need to light a fire under someone, and I'm going to attempt to do so at lunch today. 1970s, wonderful time. Journalism, broadcasting. Many of our journalism and broadcasting students went on to, they had to take government, by the way. They went on to be some of the nucleus for WWPA. And I would see them at the Bloomsburg Fair or at the Hughesville Fair. They would always call me over for an interview. Many of the people that are still with WWPA were here as journalism students and broadcasting students. Oh, you ask about style earlier, and I didn't really respond to it. But did I bring the same approach to the college that I had at the high school? And the answer is that I don't know for sure. But I do remember that someone in the technical area, carpentry, built me a little lectern, which I carried from one classroom to another. And I remember teaching on my feet 90% of the time, unless it was an intro to ed class, which lent itself to a little round chair discussionary type thing. But I remember also showing up in a vacant classroom where my class was going to meet and putting an outline of my notes for the day on the board. And then as I lectured, rather than have to write on the board with my back to the class, I simply would refer to whatever I had already written on the board. And then later, when we got into computers and copying machines, it was easy for me to hand out a copy of, just like a minister with a sermon, I would hand out an outline of what I'm going to be talking about today. And again, I thought it was a technique that that helped and so forth. I did that. Don't want to hold you up here now. Let's quickly do this. Oh, I just want to mention, too, the long journey from the original cafeteria to the June chef, the young chef. Can you imagine? Now serving food at the Kentucky Derby. Yes, our people, you know. And what a long way we've come. And with those people, they certainly had their heads screwed on, knew what they were doing, and developed a fine program, which is widely known now. Even have their own television program occasionally. But what a long journey they've traveled.
Well, what was food service available for students and faculty when you came in 65? Was there anything?
Yeah, there was hot food available at a very moderate cost. I remember you went over into that, what became the first administrative building, again, where there was a school buses came up around the front of the building and left off those school students that still came here from the sponsoring districts. I don't know what the name of that building was, but there was a flagpole out front, almost directly across from Klump. It would have been immediately east of the auditorium or the gymnasium.
You're talking about a new building built in the 70s?
Yeah, evidently.
Learning Resource Center?
Yeah, well, yes. Back in there, there was hot food available.
Okay. What about in 65, though, before that?
Oh, we went over to Sillow's. We went to Sillow's, which is directly across the street from the Straley Building.
So there was no place available, really?
No. Then also there was another little place down at the corner of is that Basin Street at the other end down there? You go down 3rd and the first right-hand turn. There was another little bar and grill in there that you could go to.
Dandy's Diner, you're talking about?
Well, I'm not sure what the name of it was.
Denny's Diner was located on Susquehanna Street, down below what was the railroad tracks, which no longer tries to go across the campus. But, okay.
Yeah, well, I remember that. Didn't refer to it earlier. I guess that's it, Fort Pitt.
As you look back at your career at WAC, what do you have the greatest satisfaction regarding your teaching career and your interaction with students?
Well, I hate to use a cliche like I made a difference, but in many aspects, whether you're a kindergarten teacher or an elementary or middle school or high school or a college teacher, I think the opportunity exists to have an impact on some people's lives. And it is gratifying for me to know that the former DA, that the former mayor of Williamsport, some of the magistrates that are currently sitting, city councilmen, teachers up at the high school, had been in my classroom at one time or another, the college solicitor, and I could go on and on and on with a litany of names that have crossed my path at one time or another. And it's very gratifying, rewarding, to have one of them refer to me one time as, oh, there's one of my heroes. I said, how could that be? I was never one of your football coaches or your wrestling coach. How could that be? Well, and they would go on to expound, and I don't want to blow my horn, but how you made a difference in my life, you know? And teaching, and I repeat, at whatever level, can be a very gratifying journey. And it has been for me. It's 20 years went by here so quickly, and in a sense, I regret that I'm still not here as a gray-haired old guy with no hair, I guess, still holding a captive audience. And I do admit that you have a captive audience, so they don't have a lot of choice, you know, in putting up with you. And not everybody loved Robert Kissel, I'm sure of that. Many did, but not everybody did, I'm sure. But it was a great experience. I loved every minute of it, as did I my high school career. I loved every grade level, 7th and 8th grade as well, inquisitive, fun. Yep.
Great. Well, thank you, Bob, for sharing your memories. It's so clear that you've had then and still have this enthusiasm for teaching, for the community, and especially for students. And you, a little while ago, you used the expression to light a fire in people, and it's so obvious that you then and still have this fire and have shared it with us.
Well, thank you very much. I consider it a compliment that you ask me. My memory is rather shaky in some of the areas, especially buildings, but my fondness for the college, my dedication to the college, and my hopes for its future will never dim.
Well, I think you said it so well. The campus was people more than it was buildings. Thank you.
Thank you.